Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Breaking Point podcast. Today, we're here with Danielle. And Danielle is a... Are you a psychotherapist? You're a...
No. By profession, I'm a mental health nurse.
Okay, by profession, you're a mental health nurse, yeah. But you're also a coach.
I'm a coach, yes. And I'm also an investigator for clinical incidents. So...
What does that mean?
My finger in a few pies. So if there's an incident in a clinical setting in a hospital, I investigate it and support the coroner with an investigation.
Wow. So to go deep pretty early on, the whole Lucy Letby thing, has that been a thing that's... I imagine that's quite damaging for the whole reputation of the NHS, and there's been a lot of clawing back. Reputation maybe, so yeah, but that maybe we can get to that later, but we won't start with that. But that is really interesting. So what got you into... did you start off as a mental health nurse first? Is that where your sort of origin was?
Yeah, absolutely. So I wanted to be a nurse, and I had an interest in mental health, so I thought I'd become a mental health nurse. And I make it sound like it's easy. It's not. It was three grueling years of lots of placement, lots of essays, assignments. And it, you know, I never look back really. It's been 10 years now and I absolutely love it. I'm a very proud nurse. So yeah, I'm a definite advocate for the nursing profession.
So what does a mental health nurse actually do? What does the job entail for people that may not know?
Well, I think it's only fair for me to try and recruit you early. There are a lack of us, so if you're still interested in mental health nursing, it's not too late. So
no, that's
maybe fair. Give that some thought. But
I will do.
But it's quite complex. I'm sure it doesn't surprise you. There's a lot that goes into it. I think there's sort of common misconception about mental health nursing that perhaps, you know, we're sort of limited to one setting, which I think traditionally people think we're on ward. So what I think the general population, probably if they haven't had any experience with mental health nursing in a clinical setting, they probably think of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
I don't think most people... I don't think most people know what... have even heard of a mental health nurse, actually. Do you get that? I don't think most people have even heard of a mental health nurse. So, yeah, it's interesting.
We're sort of a hidden profession in a sense, because I think when people think of nursing, they think of a doctor's assistant.
Absolutely.
You know, but we are a profession in our own right. We are academics, and it is incredibly difficult. Traditionally, we'd start off on the wards, and you would be a charge nurse, and you'd support the patients who require hospital admission. You know, again, there's so many different environments. You could have, you know, an assessment ward, which would be acute mental health. You could have forensic nursing, where you'd be supporting patients in places like Broadmoor or Rampton. Similarly, you can be a mental health nurse in the community. So you are supporting people who are living with mental illness in the community. And the aim of every hospital admission is to discharge your patient into the community. You know, we want our patients to live in the community where they can live safely and happily, but with support. But again, mental health is not an exact science. So it's something that takes a lot of time, a lot of, you know, input from other professionals as well. We work alongside occupational therapists, psychologists, consultant psychiatrists. And we work alongside peer support workers who have had, you know, their own experiences with mental illness, and they are invaluable to what we do. You know, they provide a lot of insight, and it it's very validating and reassuring for the patients to be able to have someone work with them that knows exactly what they're going through, because it's really quite scary. And like I said, it's complex. But we also work with our healthcare assistants, who, especially on the ward, are the eyes and ears of everything that we do. You know, we rely on so many other people to do our job as well. But, you know, nurses, we are the spearhead of the NHS. And they're, you know, there aren't enough of us. And it's very difficult circumstances to work in. You know, we face a lot of assault, a lot of abuse. The patients are very unwell. So, yeah, it's, I could talk all day really about what a mental health nurse does, but predominantly we work with people with mental illness where we are supporting them to lead better lives, to lead lives where they can feel part of the community, not feel ostracized, to break down a lot of the stigma that still exists, and to do it in a way that's meaningful for them, really.
Wow, that was, you're very well spoken, aren't you? Very eloquent. Yeah, that was, I love the, I'm going to, you are, really, definitely. I'm going to use that, I think it's the title of the video. Nurses are the spearhead of the NHS. That's brilliant, brilliantly well put. Absolutely. Yeah, I like that. I like that a lot. Yeah. Yeah, because so I've worked in schools and special needs schools, particularly for a few years after I'd just turned 18. And an elder teacher said to me once or something, they were having a discussion about who the most important people in the school are, and, you know, the bureaucracy and the hierarchy of things that everyone that goes on nowadays, and SLT and or senior management team or whatever, and then the teaching assistant. And he said, the most important people in a school are obviously the students. And then who has most direct hands-on time with the students? It's the teaching assistants. So they're the second most important people. Then it goes the teachers. So in theory, what he was kind of saying is the perceived hierarchy of head teacher down to teaching assistants is actually, in reality, it's reverse in terms of actual input and control, maybe not control, but input and impact. And nurses fall into that exact same category of who spends most time with the patients. It is the nurses, and it's that sort of, we have to, yeah, I know. I don't know. I probably can't. I don't have enough information to talk about the state of what's going on at nurses. I mean, you obviously do, but to give my opinion, I don't really know enough. But what do you think is going on with nursing as a profession at the moment, and where are we getting it wrong as a society and maybe even as a government as well?
Yeah, it's a tricky subject, really, isn't it? I mean, I think particularly the government are getting it wrong in most areas, unfortunately, not just with healthcare, but with policing and, you know, areas where we work with the public. We are generally, what you say about the hierarchy is a good point to make, because generally speaking, people don't know what it is that we do. We are professions that, you know, are really necessary. We're really needed to make society a better place, a safer place. But we are really bottom of the barrel when it comes to lots of things like pay. Again, with the assaults that we face, with the danger that we face, you know, the NHS pay scale, you know, I'm not ashamed to say is laughable. If that's what we're worth, then no wonder people are leaving. You know, you just have to look back to times like COVID and the direct danger that we faced.
Yeah.
And the people that I worked with, typically speaking, we didn't take any sick days during that period. You know, we persevered through, and we were grateful for the recognition that we got. But what we want is better pay. So we were grateful for the applause. We were grateful for, as I say, the recognition. But the areas that they need to improve in are lacking. You know, going back to the point you made about the hierarchy, I don't know if you've ever been on a mental health ward before, or in fact, not just a mental health ward, but any hospital ward, you'll walk in and there usually is, from my experience, a board of staff members with faces and names and job titles. And presumably that's, you know, for visitors to know who is on a ward and who is in charge. And much like you say, the domestics are at the bottom, then the HCAs, then the nurse. Yeah. And right at the top, you've got consultants, and then you've got obviously your directors and your CEOs. And, you know, I'm not disputing the fact that those people all work incredibly hard as well. But just by virtue of creating a triangular hierarchy, you are indicating there that there is a hierarchy, and that's problematic in itself, because that then can lead on to other scenarios, such as, you know, a person who wants to make a complaint, for example, they will look at that hierarchy and assume that for example, the nurse in charge is not the right person to be speaking to, you know, that they need to go higher. And no, actually, we run the wards, and without us, the hospitals would not open. So, as you mentioned, that hierarchy, that's definitely something that I've seen in the past that's always really bothered me. You know, it's sort of reminding us of our position. That is massive.
The notion of a laid out hierarchy and the sort of, I suppose, we unconsciously attach levels of, or maybe it's implicit in the structure of it, sort of levels of importance sort of built into a hierarchy like that, especially when it's played out. But I don't know if it's, I think there's an element of that, but I do think a lot of people are aware that it's not quite as simple as just a top-down structure of people at the top and then people at the bottom. I think more and more people are cottoning on to the notion that it's more like a network and a living network than a bottom down, top down sort of a tyrannical structure. Or I don't know what it's the hierarchy is such a nightmare, because hierarchies are in some ways necessary, but they always ultimately tilt, or they can often tilt towards tyranny and abuse of power, which we see all the time, especially in governments and things. And I don't know what, I think the opposite of a hierarchy is almost like chaos in some ways, or the extreme opposite, but we just have to find that balance between the two and negotiate with people how we get to that. And I certainly can't solve that problem in a 2-minute little clip of us talking, but it is a difficult thing. And you are right in how the assumptions we sometimes people can make unconsciously about us based on what we do are wrong. But at the same time, you are a nurse and you get to help people in an incredible way, but they don't get that constant feedback, these people in the offices. But I completely understand what you mean. It's very, very complicated, yeah. Difficult.
Yeah, and I think, generally speaking, the key is, with a hierarchy, what you need at the top is a good leader. You have a good leader because difficulty sort of trickle downwards. And again, because you have that pyramid shape, the people at the bottom are often the people that will feel the full force of sort of difficulties.
It's true.
But as I say, good leadership, a good leader will ensure that, as you say, that balance and that compromise does exist, and it's distributed evenly. So, yeah.
Very good. And you mentioned lockdown. I think that's another one of the confusing aspects of how we haven't seemed to have taken away the importance of key workers as much as I had anticipated we would post lockdown. You know, the phrase key workers was so present during that period, and yet we don't. It's not. They haven't moved up our understanding of how important those people are. I don't think has necessarily increased, but. Or it had, maybe it has. I don't know. It's difficult. I'm thinking about all this for the first time, so I don't really. I'm sort of not getting it completely right, but I know what you mean. When you say you get a bit of abuse, what do you mean? What, talk about some of the things that can entail and how you deal with that as a community together.
It varies, really. You know, it's always a tricky subject, because if a person is really very unwell in terms of their mental state, they lose capacity, and sometimes they can become violent, aggressive, you know, very hostile for a variety of reasons. It could be based on your gender. It could be based on your race. It could be based on your sexuality. You know, any information that they may know about you, you know, it can be used against you. And we are a very resilient, robust profession, but everybody has their limits. And I think what we need is adequate support to make sure that when those days happen, which are more often than not, it's not a case of, well, you know, you're a mental health nurse, this is what you deal with. It needs to be, again, it comes back to that leadership, doesn't it? It's about making sure that you have that debrief with your managers. It's about making sure that your emotional well-being is being supported as well. We're not robots, we work with people. And interactions with people are multifaceted. You don't know what will come of any given shift, whether that be in the community or not. I think there's a common misconception, again, that nursing in the community is probably safer than on a ward, but no, because you are usually alone. And you're going into strange environments where, you know, this might be the first time you've ever met somebody. It could be somebody that isn't well known to mental health services or known at all. And that prior risk assessment hasn't been completed. So you are going into an environment that's very risky. Typically, you would try to go in pairs, but again, there are a lack of us. So rather than the person not be seen, you would go on your own. It's not an ideal situation, but again, if that person has an immediate need, there are certain teams, for example, like crisis teams, who will go and see that person very early on. You know, it just varies. You don't know what situation you are walking into. But it's bittersweet, because at the same time, I'm speaking for myself here, but I do know that my colleagues and my friends who are mental health nurses really love their job. They love what they do. They're very passionate about it. And it is always really wonderful to see someone that you've worked with for a period of time get better. You know, that person has come to you for help and support, and that's really what we want for them. But we need the resources and the support to be able to do that. So again, it's always a very tricky scenario. But in terms of, you know, the dangers that we face, again, there are lots of professions that face dangers in their job, most professions, in fact. But you can often come up against cultures within nursing where staff are so, you know, used to the abuse that it isn't reported to the police and things like that. But the NHS in particular have a zero tolerance policy, and it's not a policy that's often followed. So that, again, is quite complex. Yeah, it's a complex situation, because some staff don't want to report it because they feel as though that they're wasting police time, or they feel as though that it's unfair on the patient because the patient might not be very well. But actually, if we don't report it, you know, it's a controversial subject, but I'm very much in the frame of mind of that if a crime is committed, it needs to be reported to the police. So,
yeah
you'll get many different opinions on that. It's conversations that we have amongst each other. But it is something that...
Are we talking like proper... Like, are we talking like physical abuse and things like that?
Yeah.
Because you said the word crime. I didn't realize... I mean, I assumed that it was occasional, but I guess I underestimated just how vulnerable these people are and how that can often result in dire circumstances for you and them.
Well, we do... Yeah, I mean, we also work with violent offenders that have a history of, you know, multiple offences. Again, it is what we do, but nobody goes to work to be assaulted, so it could be a physical assault. I know members of staff who have been attacked to the point where they have to go to hospital, where they've stayed in hospital. And sometimes patients also attack each other. And staff have to intervene, and we don't have the luxury of a security team. We have each other, so we form a response team, and we have to respond to an incident ourselves. So that is an additional sort of danger that, you know, presents itself in any given day. It all sounds very negative. We also...
No.
You know... It sounds... I'm not doing a good job here of trying to bring people into nursing, am I? It's also an environment where you have wonderful opportunities to study in further education. There's lots of, you know, opportunity to, for nurses in particular, to become prescribers if that's something that you'd be interested in. You know, there's lots of CPDs available. You know, and more than anything, you build a relationship with your team that is unbreakable. Yeah. You learn to rely on each other in really tricky situations, and, you know, that in itself, you know, some of my closest friends are some of the people I worked with during lockdown. So absolutely, it builds wonderful relationships, and it's an experience that you go through together that only you can understand for each other. So yeah, there's lots of positives as well. So try not to focus on it.
Everyone... I'm aware of the positives of working in that industry completely. And I'm sure most people know, sort of inherent really, working in the industry of helping people is also fulfilling for yourself as well. But we don't worry. Still go and apply to be a mental health nurse, guys. Just ignore all that stuff. It's not the full story. Yes. And you said something a minute. Yeah, exactly. You said something a minute ago about how your friends during COVID, some of the people you work with during COVID have become incredible friends. And it is that the sense of cohesion and working with a shared goal in mind and pursuing a purpose that you all can subjugate yourself to. And, you know, it's like having a higher calling, isn't it, to some degree, to use a sort of a will be term. So I really like that. That's good, and it's a great way of making friends, to be fair, when you have something that you're all have in common, I suppose, and that you're passionate about. So that's great. What specifically are you interested in terms of, are there any specific sort of sectors of mental health or environments that you're interested in, or is it just all round for you?
So historically, I've worked with adults and children. I started working with adults on wards, but then I moved into the community, and I worked with a crisis team and a mental health liaison team that work in hospital A&Es. So that was really interesting, something that I really enjoyed. Following that, I moved into CAMHS, which is Children's Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services. And that was amazing. I really enjoyed it. I had a great time. you know, that was a crisis team, and that just so happened to be at the start of lockdown. So that was really quite an intense period of my career. But, you know, what a better time to try and support children in particular. You know, it was really quite a scary time for everyone. And I think, you know, children in particular just need that additional sort of nurturing and support. Some of those children, you know, come from really quite turbulent environments, and they don't have, you know, the support that they need in place. So I think that when you work in CAMHS, it's so much more than just a job. You know, it sounds like a cliche thing to say, but it's so true. You're working with these really vulnerable kids that are still developing. Yeah. You know, their brains haven't even finished growing yet.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's something about working with children, especially if you have an agreeable nature. So you're high in personality trait agreeableness, which means that you're compassionate and you're interested in helping others. It sounds like a virtue, but as everything, it's got its sort of darker and not so ideal side. But yeah, there's something about working with children that kind of mimics like a family unit, doesn't it? And one of the things that I've seen kids becoming more and more dysregulated, just generally, and less and less emotionally buoyant, I suppose. And I think we're messing around with, it's a very complicated, but the schools nowadays are taking on more of a parental role than the parents are, quite often, because the parents can be somewhat absent as a result of various things. And as a result of that, the family unit is getting quite a bad rap. But in my opinion, I think that the family unit is pretty vital for a child's development and flourishing. It's not even my opinion. The stats pretty much prove that. So the environment's continuously changing around us, and this is basically what you're doing. This is your job to some degree. The environment is continuously changing around us, and we are having to continue to adapt and acclimatize to it. And I guess people that work in mental health is a very good indicator. And the people that work on the front line of mental health are very, very much involved in that process. And that's a pretty big responsibility to take on. And, you know, going back to what we spoke about earlier on, most people just aren't aware of the responsibility that it entails, not through malevolence. There's a great quote that I love, which is, in life, always assume ignorance before malevolence. And I think that applies for an awful lot of things. So, yeah, that's really interesting. Have you got something to say about that? Because that was quite a lot of talking from me.
No, I just wanted to pick up on one thing you said. You used the word dysregulation, and I think it's a really important word to use, actually, because you see a lot of emotional dysregulation, especially in children. And emotional dysregulation is not mental illness. So teaching children, coaching them with regards to how to manage emotional dysregulation, how to recognize the signs, and how to essentially reach out, especially when they feel... One moment. Hope you can cut this out, because my phone just started ringing.
It's all right.
Sorry about that.
Don't worry about it. I cut loads out. It's all good.
The emotional dysregulation in children, especially now, is, you know, massive. And what's important is that we are teaching children that experiencing emotional dysregulation does not mean they are mentally unwell. And I think that especially in, you know, children's services, especially, you know, when children are quite young, what we don't want to do is give children a diagnosis that will be with them forever. That will, especially a diagnosis that is incorrect. And it does happen. So children, as I say, that emotional dysregulation happens. It happens to all of us. It happens to children. It happens to adults. But some children are not in the right environment to learn how to manage and develop, you know, those feelings and those emotions. And sometimes they need CAMHS to help carry them through just for a period. It doesn't necessarily mean that we need to medicate them and to hospitalise them. That is a very extreme response, especially, as I say, with children. Absolutely. So, yeah, but again, I'm sure this is something you've come across yourself.
Yeah, one of the people that she's just retired, but one of the people that I used to work with who's been at the same school for 30 plus years, I think, she said, yeah, the kids have changed massively compared to how I started. They talk back a lot more. They've got far more confidence and arrogance about them, which makes sense. And I'm not sure if that's necessarily a bad thing. I don't know. It depends. And then they're also a lot more energetic and dysregulated. And yeah, I mean, there's so many things that go into that. I mean, like the change in food that we consume and the internet and technology, all these things will have gone on to impact that. But it's really interesting because I've got a bit of I went to CAMHS when I was younger because I had really, really, really bad anxiety growing up. And I was on, they put me on, I was very severe. And they put me on a sertraline. To sort of just take the edge off my anxiety. So it is navigating. It's because one of the things that thing with kids is that, as you said earlier on, their brains aren't fully developed yet, so they can't articulate and express themselves with words to the degree that an adult can. So they have to use their behaviors and use their actions as a way of expressing themselves, and both deliberately and both consciously and unconsciously. So it's really difficult to get through to kids, especially really young ones, because they really are just little like beings walking around. They're not really people yet, so it's very complicated. Right. Yeah.
Can I ask you a question?
I had some questions. Yes, definitely. Ask me a question.
Did you feel that the sertraline helped you?
Yes, I did. I went on. So I was 9, and I was diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder, and maybe OCD type like symptoms. And it did definitely help me, to be fair, especially for that first year, like, which makes sense because the original exposure to it would, I guess it's stronger then, and then you become somewhat desensitized to it and you have to up the dosage. But yeah, that first year was really, really good. But I also, there's a condition called PANDAS. I don't know if you've heard of, this has become about me. I don't want it to become about me. But there's a condition called PANDAS, which is a pediatric autoimmune neuropsychiatric. It's when strep infections affect the brain. I don't know if you heard. Have you heard of it?
I have, yeah.
You have? Oh, wow, that's great. That's brilliant. Yeah, so I was diagnosed with that tenuously because it was, you know, this was about 10, 12 years ago now. So I'm 23 and I was about 12, 13 at the time, when I got really, really ill with it in theory. And so there's all these things, then, you know, you throw autism into the mix and ADHD and all these neurodivergent things that go on. So yeah, working with kids, it's a case by case basis, isn't it, a lot of the time, which is complicated, makes it really difficult.
Yeah, I think that's exactly yeah. It you've hit the nail on the head there. It's about having person-centered care. An individualized approach to one person, you know, will obviously vary to another.
And that's why blanket rules and blanket sort of approaches to supporting a person, yeah, are unhelpful. And that, I guess that's why I asked you if the sertraline was helpful for you, because, you know, medication in particular, especially with children, it varies in terms of its effectiveness. So thankfully, it was beneficial for you. And that's a positive experience. And I think that I guess medication, again, can become, a really controversial topic. In some circumstances, it is quite literally what will prevent a person from, you know, ending their life. Or, you know, it can sound really quite morbid and dramatic, but that is quite literally what we're dealing with here. It could be the one thing that stops that from occurring.
Yeah, in the extremes, absolutely. Medication is a godsend, isn't it? And one of the things that they throw around a lot in like the CBT community and therapeutic community is the notion that you need, quite often people can't access therapy effectively unless they're on some form of medication, because they need something to, you know, take the edge off their emotions just to some degree. And that's why medication can be so important, especially if you're in a highly, because so much about anxiety and particularly anxiety, but to some degree depression is unconscious, it's subconscious, it's programmed, it's a result of repeated exposure to things, and it's programmed into us. So the conscious talking back and forth isn't helpful. It's a somatic, it's a bodily experience, which is why medication can be so powerful and so vital. But I still think psychedelics will be the way forward. So touch wood, we get those psychedelics coming out.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I think, I've already said this on a podcast today, in my more conspiratorial moments, I watched a documentary about psychedelics, and they said that in the 60s, when they came out, they were all, the government hushed them away and pushed them away. And in my, I think the conspiracy side of me thinks, well, that was because they knew the power that they
had. Because they were.
And they didn't want us, because they work, yeah. And, but instead what we'll do is we'll pump them with SSRIs and benzodiazepines, which will some kind of help, but basically kind of numb them a little bit and sort of subdue the symptoms. Whereas if we can just push, I mean, I don't know, but if we can get psychedelics a little bit more controlled and tested, I really think they'll be quite, the statistics are quite phenomenal, actually, especially with addiction and things like that. Like one psychedelic trip cures people of their like 20 plus year alcoholism or smoking addiction or something like that. And, you know, I'm sure you're aware as alcoholism is a truly awful thing to witness and to go through. The way it ruins people and ruins families is, I think one person I spoke to or said it's the devil. Alcoholism is the devil. And you could say that about a lot of pretty much all mental health conditions, especially when they're pushed to their extremes. So yeah, that's hopefully your job will start to, hopefully you'll get to hear about what's going on with psychedelics before the rest of us do. And let me know, because I'm very interested.
I certainly will. I mean, it's an interesting point to talk about addiction, because I guess you'd be looking at, for all intents and purposes, a personality type. And quite often what you see in drug and alcohol services are people that go from illegal addiction to legal addiction. So going back to what you said about benzo and things like that, I mean, depending on how deep into the rabbit hole you want to go, you're looking at a multi-million pound profit here for prescribed medications. Absolutely. There's money to be made in prescriptions. I mean, I remember watching a documentary a while ago that said that in America, I think I don't know if these statistics are still accurate, but America is responsible for 70% of the world's prescriptions. 70%. And I think the ratio of prescription to person was 5 to 1. And that's obviously your legal medication. And to me, that's an addiction. You know, painkillers, especially, and things like that, they're very addictive medications, and they're very easy to get addicted to. So, as I say, in my experience, you see, for example, somebody that is addicted to heroin, they go from being addicted to heroin to addicted to methadone. The addiction still exists. So what we're not addressing is the addiction. Why is this person addicted? Why did they start using drugs? Why did somebody start drinking heavily? Often, not always, but often you'll find that there is a trauma that exists, and that the drug addiction, is a coping mechanism.
Coping mechanism.
Yeah. So it's a very, that person would require, a lot of psychotherapy to really dig deep into understanding their addiction and why they became addicted and why that became their coping strategy. And most people can't afford that privately. And to the waiting lists on the NHS are obviously incredibly long. So you end up with...
Definitely, yeah.
A very, very tricky situation.
Absolutely. Have you watched any of the series about the Purdue Pharma and the opioid crisis?
I haven't.
Have you watched any of that? Okay, so do you know about the Purdue Pharma and the OxyContin sort of catastrophe? Do you know about that? So,
I know the history of
if anyone out there is
drug, yeah.
Yeah.
The ethics, obviously, around how...
So that's an...
started prescribing it, and it was essentially marketed out.
It was marketed. It was a prescribable heroin, effectively, and it was marketed with completely false science. And obviously, I imagine, I would hope, touch wood, that something like that can't happen anymore as a result of better legislation. But, God only knows. So yes, the degree to which the desire for monetizable assets props up something like the pharmaceutical company is quite phenomenal. It's complicated. And you're right, the NHS waiting list is so long for these things. And this is one of the reasons why I started the podcast, because I want to try and get more content of people like yourself that have got great wisdom to share for free out there, so that they don't have to go and chat to some therapist who maybe can only see them for 6 sessions and then it's goodbye, or something like that. Where, so it's difficult, to say the least. This whole conversation, it's all very difficult topics, isn't it? And that is quite difficult. Did I say difficult enough? I don't think I did.
It is difficult, right. Though. It is the correct
word. So what... It is the correct word, yeah. Complicated and difficult, 100%. Okay, what else? There's so much else. I'm overwhelmed with things to talk about. Have you got any topics that you want to talk about that you want to sort of hash out with me, or you've got anything on your mind that you think is important to mention that you want to explore, or... Not really.
I'm happy to talk about anything and everything. So whatever you think would be interesting content, I'm happy to get involved in. I know a little bit about, a little bit about everything. That's not true. That sounds really arrogant, doesn't it? But it's, I'm happy to talk about
everything. I know what you mean. That's good. Right. So I know what I will ask you about. I will ask you about how do you cope with some of the seemingly awful things that you probably hear about, and how does it impact your mental health, and what are your strategies? Because that's obviously really important when you're in a position like you are in, to manage and receive support.
I think, it's something that doesn't go away. You can desensitize to some of the really harrowing things you see and hear. But particularly when you are a newly qualified nurse, one of the really stressful situations I was often left in, and I'm sure any newly qualified nurse who's listening to this will have experienced this. When you qualify, you're a registered nurse, and you can go and work on a ward. You're given medication keys, and then all of a sudden you are running a ward, and it's absolutely terrifying. And some of these wards are huge. You know, they can have up to 20 plus patients on them, and you know, it is a bit like driving. You don't actually learn how to drive till you pass your test. So even though you are safe to practice, you need the experience. Experience is vital. And sometimes you are, you know, put in a situation where you have to make quick decisions. And those decisions are scary. You know, so I found what was helpful for me was I needed to decompress with friends, colleagues, you know, essentially supervision. And even to this day, despite my role being very different, I still have a group of friends who are really experienced nurses. And we meet once a month. We have a WhatsApp group and we decompress. We talk about stressful situations we might have had. You know, we talk about any of the work that we're doing specifically, you know, with a particular person. Obviously, everything is confidential, but we talk about scenarios and we just give each other advice. And it is supervision. Supervision is vital to what we do. You know, it doesn't matter if you've been a nurse for 50 years, you still need that decompression. If you don't have that, you end up on autopilot and you just keep going and keep going and keep going. And particularly, most of us have and do work shifts. So when you work shifts, you know, you're physically exhausted as well. You know, so I can always recall a conversation I had with a friend of mine years ago who is a general nurse. She works in general medicine. And I remember her saying, you know, general nursing is physically exhausting, but mental health nursing is mentally exhausting. And I remember at the time it outraged me because I thought, well, we're not sitting around all day doing absolutely nothing. You know, sometimes you have to get into restraints with patients. You know, sometimes you have to administer IM medication in a really stressful situation. You know, and that's not nice for the staff or the patient. You know, sometimes you are, you know, running a ward full of really unwell people, but having to support your staff at the same time. And I say sometimes, that's a normal shift. So I remember thinking, is this sort of a misconception about mental health nurses that we are just chatting all day? I mean, I'd love to do that. I want to spend more time with the patients chatting because that's exactly what they need, but that's not the luxury that we have. And that's why, as I say, that decompression is so important, because if you don't express how you feel and you don't always get that opportunity, you know, in a work setting, it is a luxury. You internalize it, and you know, transference is a real thing when you're working in an environment where there's so much high expressed emotion and distress. You absorb that and you take it home. You know, so you need an opportunity to offload. You need an opportunity to talk about what you've seen or what you've heard. Or, you know, some of our patients do take their own lives. As I said, it's a very sad fact of what we do. You know, and it's always sad. Always, you always feel as though you've let that person down, like you could have done something differently. You know, and you end up blaming yourself for that. You know, but unfortunately, you know, if you don't learn how to talk about it, you end up with so much guilt and stress, and it prevents you from being able to do your job in a really meaningful way. You know, it's really important, I find, for me to take time away to reflect as well. It's really easy to think, I need to be there, I need to help, you know, we're short on staff, or we have to do this, or we have to do that. Again, this is, you know, this is a very, you know, familiar scenario for anyone that's working in a hospital setting, or again, as I say, in the community. But you have to take that protected time for yourself. You know, you have to look after your own well-being, because if you don't, the machine will eat you up. It sounds, you know, again, I'm sounding quite negative, but you are essentially an employee number, you know. So if you don't look after yourself, you know, you will just stay that employee number. You know, so to recap, my strategies are, I talk to my colleagues, I talk to my friends in a way that feels meaningful. I take time away. And you do learn to walk away from work and to disconnect, because you have to reflect, you have to think. Otherwise, you know, your entire existence will be what you do for a living. And despite being passionate, you know, and loving what you do, you are still a person that has needs and emotions that require looking after as well. So I don't know if I've just rambled on a bit there.
No, absolutely not. That was very, very helpful and insightful. Yeah, very. Yeah, it's true. You are a, you know, it's, some people have more of a capacity to take on the needs of others and manage their own. But even like you, for example, and the people that you work with in the industry, but even they, everyone has their breaking point, and everyone has their point of where the importance and compassion for others can be worn out, and it can be it can dry up, and you've got to take time to refill your own pot, I guess, for lack of a better phrase. So that is really important. I think as a society, it's not necessarily that we underappreciate people to the degree to which we do, even though I think if you ask people, they would say they're very appreciative of everything that nurses do. It's just, it's not like everything, it's not continuously on their mind, because there's other things going on. But I think it's just lack of awareness a lot of the time. You know, it's, as humans, it's very difficult, because everything that works well is invisible to us. It's only the things that don't work that we actually see in some way. So when something functions, we just ignore it. You know, we have such a negativity bias around those things, around in general, in everything. We have a negativity bias, and it's really hard to sort of overcome that. And, you know, obviously for survival reasons, we're designed to be like that. And, you know, hence why, you know, you can only, you know, people can get incredibly, incredibly depressed, but you can only be so happy at the end of the day. You know, there's a happiness sort of caps out, but depression and anxiety and mental health is a bottomless pit to some degree, as many people find out, unfortunately, to say the least. So it's very hard. We haven't touched on this. There's two parts of you that I haven't even touched on yet, and we're nearly an hour in. Talk about the coaching aspect and how that's going on, and what got you into that.
So coaching, I feel, for me, was something that I did naturally in a work setting, but because of the bureaucracy that you're surrounded by, and you are restricted in what you can say and do, I guess, you know, it's, you can have a specific approach. You know, my approach is adaptable to whoever I'm speaking to, but I do very much you know, advocate for accountability and helping yourself. And I guess that's where the coaching comes in. But you are quite limited, you know, in being able to have that approach when you don't design the model, when the model is not your own. But also some of the people that I work with now as a coach, you know, those people may have a history of serious mental illness or, you know, multiple diagnoses, but they are well enough to engage in coaching. Actually, you know, coaching is great in many different areas of life, you know, many different elements of life. But if somebody is extremely unwell, requiring hospital admission and, you know, psychotropic medication, they aren't going to be receptive to a coaching approach. So obviously it's, you know, something that it requires, you know, it's for a specific purpose. But I guess sort of after, well, during lockdown, I really reflected on it and thought, this is something I'm doing anyway, but more so, you know, for family members and staff, and supporting them through a difficult experience, you know, especially as I said, in CAMHS, you are not just working with children, you're working with the entire family. And sometimes that family is the local authority. Absolutely. You know, sometimes that family is an older brother or sister because they don't have parents. So what you do is you adapt your style to the person, to what their individual needs are. And as I said, my approach, I felt that in order for me to really model that, I needed to go out on my own and set that up individually. And I did, and I've never looked back. So it's something I really enjoy. It's, you know, it's really rewarding to see results. It's really rewarding to see someone helping themselves, you know, to set those goals with somebody, to put a plan together and watch them achieve what it is that they set out to achieve. And you said something earlier about certain people having, let's say, six sessions of CBT and things like that. Well, you know, coaching is not a traditional therapy.
Yeah.
But it is therapeutic and it can be therapeutic. And I find that a lot of my clients have already, you know, experienced that process of six sessions, you know, or they go back and their medication is changed and then it's another six sessions. And, you know, and they don't feel like anything changes. They don't feel like it helps them. It's not everyone, but for these people in particular that are able to reach out and find an alternative approach to what they feel they need, you know, it's really rewarding to hear them say and to watch them achieve what they've been trying to achieve and that they felt they weren't previously able to do. But as I said, they have to be well enough. So that period of stabilizations, some of my clients, I can, you know, the mental health background, we are not just life coaching here. It is specifically mental health life coaching. And sometimes I have to stop and say, look, I think that actually at this point, what we're doing needs to be put on hold and that you need to go and speak to your GP or you need to go and speak to, you know, your community nurse or your consultant, because they do, those things still exist for them. It's not in isolation. And, you know, that's explained from the beginning. If I think that somebody is becoming unwell or relapsing, you know, or if someone stops taking their medication, I can't coach them through that situation. I can't watch them become unwell and then not take action. So that is, you know, again, it's on an individualized basis, but I just find coaching, you know, really powerful. You build up such a strong rapport with your clients and, you know, it's really empowering for them. They learn new skills. They learn new coping strategies, new mechanisms for how to manage. Again, there's a lot of that dysregulation. And when somebody, for example, becomes dysregulated, they might think that they're relapsing. So you're not relapsing necessarily. You're feeling hormonal, or you are stressed, but that doesn't necessarily equate to a relapse. And if someone thinks they're relapsing in their mental health, it might then trigger a relapse. So for them to have that additional support, not just teaching them skills for life and how to reach specific goals. For some people, their goals might be understanding how to recognize their early warning signs. Their goal might be, what do I do when I start feeling really anxious? And it can sound like something very small, but actually, anyone that's experienced chronic anxiety, even acute anxiety, is absolutely crippling. It can prevent you from your day-to-day, duties and responsibilities. And as an adult, if you've got children or you've got a job to get to, that anxiety can stop you leaving the house. That anxiety can, increase your negative thinking, and that negative thinking can lead to, really low mood and then suicidal thoughts. So it seems in isolation really small, but the domino effect is huge.
Yeah, it's the feedback loop of anxiety and depression, I suppose, which is the tendency to withdraw and to limit social engagement. And engagement in anything, to some degree, a lot of the time, it imbues you with a desire to be incredibly introverted and lonesome. And then that can make you more anxious. And, this loop just begins to start whirling and spiraling, and it can get really hard. So another thing I was just thinking as you were talking is, you were saying how it's great that you get to build a rapport and you get to watch these people develop. I suppose every job is like this to some degree. But another great thing about being involved in working with people on a psychological and emotional level is that you also develop you also develop individually as a person. So, in theory, 10, 15 years time, you will be a better mental health nurse/coach than you are today because of your growing experiences. And that will then make you be able to help more people and people in a greater way. And it's an investment into, we have no idea how much our actions ripple out into the wider world, and how I really do believe that everyone is at the center of the universe to some degree, and the actions that we all take ripple out into everyone else and have a far greater impact on the world than we actually give it credit, than we actually can probably ever understand. You're also developing yourself in multiple ways, as well as developing the people that you're working with. So it's a great profession to get into, to be fair. Incredible thing.
It's really important. Yeah. And I think, the great thing about understanding and talking about mental health and mental illness, because they are two different things, is breaking down the stigma. And I know that it's such a buzz phrase, isn't it? Break down the stigma. But we actually are breaking down the stigma. You can tell people now that you have anxiety without, feeling humiliated or people not understanding that actually anxiety is really common.
Yeah.
One of the things that I always talk about are intrusive thoughts. I have intrusive thoughts every day. But somebody who isn't, in an environment or, has ever spoken about their experiences, they might think that is, again, in isolation. They might think, oh, there's something wrong with me. No, we're all experiencing intrusive thoughts. We just don't talk about them. And admittedly, some of them we aren't going to talk about with everyone. It might sound a bit peculiar to some people, but it's about understanding, the context of that intrusive thought. You know, if you feel that you are going to act on it, it's at that point, if you start making plans or, you know, setting dates or, you know, things like that, that is typically, you're looking at an early warning sign there. But if you're having an intrusive thought where, you know, it could be something as small as, I'm sure everyone's experienced, you know, talking to someone that they're not really familiar with, and then something pops into your head really quickly about that person. And it might just be something weird, like, imagine I just walked off mid-conversation, you know. I have those type of thoughts all the time. But you have to learn to recognize that it's actually just your imagination. It is actually just your brain processing what's going on at that moment. But again, if we talk about it, it seems less strange, and it becomes more common. And again, like I said about anxiety, we can talk about it now. Depression, we can talk about it. You know, I guess the key is if somebody feels that they can talk about it, but if they hear others talking about it, they're more likely to. So,
absolutely, yeah. I had a lot of obsessive thoughts growing up. And I, exactly what you just pointed out, I wasn't aware of just how normal they are. And I saw a thing on your Instagram about this and how it's, or maybe I read an article. It's, I think it was on Instagram, but it's not the thoughts that cause the trouble. It's what we ascribe to the thoughts, the meaning that we ascribe to the thoughts and how we perceive them as being important. And I think, well, I kind of two things. One, that's quite indicative of the tendency to, what is it? We're a very thinking based society, I think, in a lot of ways. And we attach a lot of meaning to our thoughts and intellect and the importance of that, and everything's so ordered and structured, and we lose the importance of feeling, I suppose. Like Carl Jung, who's a psychologist, talked about the importance of thinking and feeling, and there's, I think, sensing and judging. I don't know, the four main ways of perceiving the world to some degree. And your thoughts can rip you apart. I mean, your feelings can as well, to be fair. But I think understanding that you are not your thoughts is a really great exercise for people to, that's what meditation sets out to do to some degree. I've realized we've been going for a long time, so I'll ask the final couple of questions. What do you, both coaching and in your, as a mental health nurse, what are the most common things that people are suffering from now? Not as in symptoms, but what are the things that people are struggling with most?
I would say, number one, low self-esteem. Low self-esteem can really impact you, again, day to day. So much like we're saying about anxiety, it's something that isn't necessarily easy to recognize, but when you get to the root of what somebody is experiencing and what they're feeling, the way that they view themselves and the way that they think other people view them can really impact the way that a person fits into, well, the way that they feel they fit into the world. You know, to have low self-esteem can prevent you from, if you start small, looking at things like going for a new job, applying for a new job. You know, it can prevent you from leaving a job you're unhappy in. You know, it can prevent you from, you know, even going into the local shop because you're worried that people are judging you, or you're worried that the way that you look isn't the way that you should look or the way that people think you should look. And again, it's, as you said, it's understanding that your thoughts are not you. You are not your thoughts. But equally, that's the thoughts of other people. And unfortunately, the reality is we live in a really superficial, judgmental world. You know, even things like what we're doing today, what we put online, someone will judge that. There will be an opinion on that. And what we say will be scrutinized and examined, but you have to have a level of self-esteem and confidence to be able to do that, to say, okay, yes, I will be scrutinized, maybe even criticized. However, this is what I think, this is how I feel, and I have a right to talk about that. But it's also about recognizing that not everyone will agree with you, not everyone will think the same as you, and that's okay. That's the art of debate. We talk about these things, we explore these things. But when your self-esteem is low, and it might be because you've been criticized as a child and you become a really unconfident adult with low self-esteem, or you're a really confident child and people have told you, why are you so confident? Don't be so confident. And then you become a really, unconfident adult with low self-esteem. So self-esteem issues are one of the major elements of concern that a client will bring to me. Sometimes they aren't even aware that it is their self-esteem that's low, but we end up there quite a lot of the time. The other one I would say that is massive is being in an unhappy marriage. The confidence to be able to address that your relationship is unhappy. So, it's important for me to obviously highlight, I'm not a relationship expert, I'm not a marriage counsellor, but if that person is coming to you to say, look, I think that my unhappy marriage is at the heart of why I'm feeling so low, then you address not the, details of the couple or the dynamics of their relationship, but you look at that person's mood, and then we can look at what they can do differently, or alternatively we look at where they might like that relationship to go. So sometimes it is that they've stopped communicating, so I can offer guidance and support on better communication skills. Living with someone does not equate to speaking. I'm sure lots of people have experience. It doesn't have to be marriage. No. It could just be, you're living together, a relationship or long distance relationship. If you don't communicate, you lose a huge chunk of the opportunity to actually understand how each other feel. And needless to say, that leads to confusion, it leads to misconception, it leads to jump into conclusions, because with a lack of communication, you fill in the blanks. Now, and you typically will fill in the blanks with, I guess, whatever it is that you think is in that blank, but that isn't going to be the same as what your partner thinks. But if you...
Yeah, you'll fill in the blanks with what you would assume, or what your, I suppose, your past experiences would lead you to assume, I suppose, as opposed to what's actually going on with them. So
it's something that takes time. And I always have that conversation at the beginning. I always ask for complete and utter commitment. This is something that is going to take time, and interestingly, a lot of my clients have a poor relationship with commitment. So we're essentially addressing, two problems at a time there for them, because I expect my clients to turn up. I expect my clients to listen to what I say. We debate. It's not a dictatorship. It's a partnership. But they are coming to me for guidance and new skills and understanding of old coping strategies and maladaptive coping strategies. So with that in mind, if they don't always follow my advice, to at least give it a go. We can never reach a compromise. We can never reach a negotiation for how we think something might need to change, and that is at the root of it all, is change. You've come to me because you want something to change. Something needs to change. We just need to figure out what that is. So that's why I use the relationship scenario, not just because it is a common reason why somebody might come to me. It's because typically, and predominantly with men, in my experience, they don't always like to say, and again, because of stigma, that they are having therapy, for example. But if they say they are having coaching, if they do want to share that with people or even their own partner, you know, they might have been told that men don't have therapy or men don't talk about their feelings or men don't cry. Obviously, women face, you know, similar stereotypes as well. But in my experience, you know, we talk about the fact that they feel more comfortable to say that they're having coaching. I can go and talk to my coach. I'm ringing my coach. I'm emailing my coach, you know, as opposed to saying I'm speaking to my therapist, because again, that therapy title is linked to something negative. Although it's not, there's a negative connotation attached to it. And I mean, that's always struck me as really interesting, because you're having that therapy because you want help, you want to improve. But again, it links us back to that stigma. People, you know, might assume that if you're seeing a therapist,
yeah,
there must be something wrong with you. Well, what does that sentence even mean? There's not something wrong with a person. A person is seeking support, seeking help, and that's positive. But that's why the person that I'm speaking to has to also recognise that it's okay to seek help. It's okay to ask for help. You don't have to have it all figured out. And I think that that's why relationships can suffer and can struggle, and each person can experience massive low mood as a result of that, because there's this expectation that once you're married or in a, you know, a long-term relationship, you should be really happy. Everything should be figured out for you. You should have, you know, nothing to feel sad about, nothing to want to reflect about. But actually, that's the complete opposite. What we know is that actually being in a relationship is incredibly exhausting. It's draining. You're taking on the emotions of another person. And again, when it comes back to that communication, once the communication breaks, if you don't figure out how to reestablish that connection, you know, the relationship becomes irreparable. So, yeah. So, I mean, it might not be, those two things might not be what someone would expect me to be at the top of the coaching list. But yeah, I mean, I don't think I was even expecting that myself. I mean, I was expecting more so sort of anxiety, depression, but those things increase your chances of having anxiety and depression. So there you've got the sort of full circle.
Yes. Yeah. How have, a bit more of a personal question. We will stop soon. How,
no, it's not.
It's getting a bit darker. And you probably won't be able to see me in a bit. How have your own personal relationships been affected by your job and your, I suppose, ability to have a deeper understanding of people and look into, see aspects of maybe your clients, the people you work with, to a much less degree in your own personal friends and family, and I guess specifically partners, because that's quite a complicated sort of dynamic there. How's that been?
I suppose it's, you know, reasonable to say that relationships struggle at various points for a variety of reasons. But I mean, I actually find that, you know, for me, becoming a mental health nurse, and I always link it back to that because that was where I guess my mental health journey began. It taught me skills I needed that I lacked to actually have better relationships. Again, it taught me the communication skills that I didn't have. It taught me how to express myself in a more meaningful way. The most detrimental part of, I guess, of my life really was working shifts. So rather than those typical scenarios you might expect, when you become ships in the night, that's when, you know, a relationship will struggle. So it will link you back then to being able to communicate. Yeah. You know, perhaps you need to make a change in your routine that allows you a better connection with your partner. You know, for me, I have two children, two boys, and they've always been my primary, you know, concern in terms of how often they see me. Am I present enough in their lives? So, you know, for me, it's often about guilt. It's often about wondering, you know, am I doing enough? You know, have I done enough? But I suppose I've reached that point now where I'm recognizing that actually everything I do is to ensure that they can have a better life, a better existence. And hopefully the skills that I have and that I've learned over the years will transfer over into my parenting. And that will create, you know, a more loving and, you know, affectionate relationship for us all. But yeah, I mean, it's hard to say, isn't it? I think it's not really a part of my life that I felt has really struggled that much, which I'm fortunate for. But it's more so
good
about, you know, maintaining relationships. That's the way I've always seen it, to put in effort. Sometimes relationships end, and that's okay as well. New relationships start. But it's about how you feel about yourself. And I think a lot of that links us back to the self-esteem. Just because a relationship ends doesn't have to equate to failure. You know, as time goes on, people change, people grow, we develop, we evolve. And, you know, I think we'd all love to be in a marriage that lasts 50 years, but that doesn't always happen. But actually, sometimes that relationship that you have at the time, whenever it may be, however long it may be, teaches you something about yourself, you learn something about the other person, and it's a really valuable lesson. Your next relationship, hopefully, I guess I'm linking this into coaching there, you see what you did in the past and you then want to do it differently later on. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for me, that's always a huge takeaway. It's what can I do differently? Exactly. What can I improve on? You know, how do I be better? So.